This is a topic that I really don't like to talk about because it's all in the past. It's done and over with. And but if there's somebody I can help, then that's awesome. Some of the topics we're going to cover, as it's in your outline, is, are people born gay? Is homosexuality a choice? Where does it come from? Is change possible, and how should Christians respond? Who would choose to be gay, and what can parents do? There are two popular thoughts of where homosexuality come from. One of it is people believe it's biological, that people are just born that way, and the research that has been done shows that that's not true. And other people believe that it's a choice, that people choose these feelings. Now, one thought is, we do choose our behavior, but we don't choose our attractions or desires. And because that desires and attractions are like feelings, they come from deep within us, and that's not a conscious choice on our part. So where does it come from? If you're not born that way and you don't choose to be that way, then where does it come from? With the research I've done, it's a developmental issue, and there are a number of factors that go into human development. And this would kind of just be a general overview of what can lead a person who has same-sex attractions. There is a whole lot of factors, and you could get deep into it, but we're just kind of do a general interview or general overview. The first one is gender identity, and that's something we all have. It's the way a person sees themselves as in terms of his own gender, how masculine a boy sees himself and how feminine a girl sees herself, and how gender identity gets formed in a person's life is how it gets formed in a healthy way, and how the developmental process can lead to same-sex attractions. This overview will be from a male perspective, obviously because that's what we have, and because the female side of it is more complex than it is with guys. Well, I'm first going to go through the healthy way a boy would develop as into a man, the male development, how it starts. It starts at birth. All babies think that they are one with their mothers. Eventually, he will realize that he is not one with his mother, and he is a separate entity. So, around a year and a half, the child starts to differentiate the difference in gender. He starts to recognize that boys are boys and girls are girls, that dad is a boy and mom is a girl. Then around the age of two and a half, they face a challenge that they must be able to begin to separate the attachment he has with his mom and start attaching to his dad. Now, it's through the relationship with his father that he starts developing a sense of his gender identity. It's a sense of who he is as a male, and he looks to his father to answer a number of questions. For example, what are boys all about? How do they walk? How do they talk? How do they act? And who am I as a boy? Do I have what it takes? Do I measure up? And this also happens at an unconscious level. So from about the age of two and a half to four, is the process when he's breaking away from mother and connecting to his father. He's looking to his father to answer all these questions. And so the father answers these questions by spending time with his son, by showing interest in his son. And specifically showing interest in him, in what the young man is interested in, or his young son. He also answers the question verbally by affirming his son. For example, I'm proud of you. You're such a fine young man. you're so brave, you're special to me. And he also conveys this in physical touch. And I know for a lot of men, that's a hard thing to do. But like hugging and holding their young son, also playing, like wrestling, you know, that kind of thing. It's through that physical touch that the boy develops a sense of his own masculinity in his body. And as he goes on around the age of this age of 5 or 6, that's when he's starting school. And so he starts to look towards his male peers to answer some of those same questions that he had for his dad. You know, what are boys all about? How do they walk? How do they talk? Who am I as a boy? Do I measure up? And do I have what it takes? Will they accept me? And do I fit in? He looks to other boys just to discover who he is in relation to them. He looks to them to be affirmed, and he spends the next couple of years bonding with the same sex. As I'm sure you remember, in elementary school, they don't want, you know, we didn't want much to do with the opposite sex. Girls were icky at the time. This is a God-given stage of development because we can't be interested in the opposite sex until we first understand our own gender. We have to know who we are and what we're all about before we can be interested in the opposite sex. Then, around 12, the early teenage years is when puberty starts. And, you know, male bonding gives him a strong sense of who he is as a male. So when he does reach puberty, he is now be interested in the opposite sex. Because he has a good sense of who he is, now he has a good sense of being interested in girls and curious on what they're all about. They're the mysterious other gender. So for the boy who develops same-sex attractions, this process doesn't happen. You know, first of all, human development is very complex, so there's a number of factors that do contribute. So for the boy who develops same-sex attractions at the age of around 2.5, a number of factors prevent him from detaching from his mother and attaching to his father. Either he doesn't have a father in his life, or his father doesn't seem safe and inviting. And you also have to realize that not all boys who have fathers are going to be gay. We know that's not the case. There are a number of factors, and you know this is only one of them. If a boy doesn't have a father figure, sometimes you know, someone from the church or someone can step in to take over that role. Also, with his father, if he doesn't perceive his father as safe and welcoming, that connection cannot happen with his father. And so, one thing to keep in mind is that perceptions are everything. It's not so much what happens to us, but how we perceive what happens to us. If a boy perceives that his father doesn't want to have a relationship with him, and that he's not safe and welcoming, he will have trouble connecting with him. Perceptions are influenced by temperament. Now, a child who is more sensitive is going to take things more personally than a person who is not so sensitive by nature. Temperament affects how we see things and things that are happening to us. Usually a boy that goes on to have same-sex attractions is more sensitive, and so he takes things to heart that happens to him, and he will also take these personally even if they weren't meant to be that way. Usually this boy is very smart, can be a perfectionist. He's usually not the most athletic person. He's more interested in, you know, other things. He really takes things to heart, and that sort of thing. So, because of perception, if he perceives his father doesn't want to have a relationship with him, you know, that's where barriers can start. And I'm sure that there, you know, I know for my father, you know, a lot of fathers love their children, but you know, they have trouble connecting with them. Another thing that'll happen is around the age of two, he'll have trouble disconnecting from mom and connecting to his father because of him not feeling safe with his father. But it is a God-given gift to connect with your father. So, and especially with your parents, but for boys, especially with their same-sex parents, it's something that, you know, we all want. And so, because he's wanting this relationship with his father and trying to connect with him, if he senses some kind of rejection, he'll try a few times to connect with him, but then we'll stop trying because I'm sure, as we all know, we can handle just so much rejection. And if he has that sense of rejection from his father, he will detach from his father internally and what the father represents, which is, you know, manhood, masculinity in general. So what we call that is defensive detachment, which in essence says, if you don't want me, then I don't want you. He rejects his father and everything that his father stands for, which, you know, is masculinity. So deep down inside of him, he's still craving that connection with dad, but he can only handle so much rejection. And so he detaches from him. So instead of, you know, soaking up masculinity at that important stage, he continues to stay connected with his mother and soaking up femininity. Usually the boy with same-sex attractions, there are other females who are pouring into his life. So, you know, he's learning all about girls and what they're all about, but he's still craving to learn about what boys are. But he's not getting that. So starting school, he'll have a hard time connecting with other boys because he feels more comfortable with girls because that's who he's always been around. So he tends to, you know, stick around with the girls. Again, the next, the need for same-sex attractions continues to be unmet. So when the child reaches puberty, he isn't going to be interested in the opposite sex because he already knows about that. What he's curious and intrigued by is boys, because that's not what he knows. And so again, when a God-given desire is not met, that doesn't mean they're going to go away. And so usually those needs will either intensify or take on another form. And so for a boy, the needs of same-sex attractions haven't been fulfilled by the time he reached puberty. And as we know, our body is changing at that time. So he starts to feel sexual feelings, and it's almost like the wires get crossed because the God-given need, for that same-sex connection, it starts to become sexualized for that hunger of male friends, of a male lover. So for him, he feels the need to have a romantic relationship with boys, but that's not what he needs. What he needs is a healthy, non-sexual, emotional, deep relationship with other boys and his father. But to him, it feels like a sexual need. It's important to realize how intense these feelings really are. When us in the church, as Christians, we come alongside him and say, you know, this is a choice. You know, shame on you. You need to stop. What happens is immediately the Christian has lost his credibility, because he says to because the boy says to himself, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. I felt this way all my life. I didn't choose to feel this way. And most of us will tell you, people like me will tell you, you know, that we have begged God to have it go away. But change is possible. Change is possible by developing those strong non-sexual relationships with other men. But these men also don't need to not downplay the severity of the situation of the person who is dealing with the same-sex attractions. Repentant homosexuals who have repented of their homosexual behaviors and are seeking to overcome their aberrant sexual desires. And so when someone we love is caught up in this sin, we are reminded more than ever of our limitations. No matter how deep we love someone, we can't force that person to do what's right. God has created us with a free will, and we can't override that, even if it's someone we love. We can, however, remind our loved ones in two unconditional truths, that God's standard and our love. We must remember that there is difference between acceptance and approval. We can continue to accept someone we love as much as possible, but keeping the relationship with this person and by keeping this relationship with the person intact. We cannot, however, approve of something that God clearly disapproves of. It's entirely possible to accept a person without approving of everything the person does or believes. God loves his creation, now disapproves of the sin that the people he loves practices in. Yeah. To address the issue of homosexuality then is to enter in a deeply God's experience, loving the person, hating the sin, and remaining steadfast in God's standard. We know that even when our best efforts to persuade the person we love has failed, God's power is still more able to accomplish his purposes. So what does the Bible say about homosexuality? You know, as we know in Genesis, God created the intent for sexual experience to be in the confines of marriage between a man and a woman. That's in Genesis 2:24 and Hebrews 3:14. So all forms of sexual activity apart from marriage, adultery, fornication, for example, are equally condemned in the Bible as homosexuality is. So in the Old Testament, homosexuality is condemned in both Leviticus 8:22 and 20:13 as being an abomination. In the New Testament, it talks about in Romans 1:24 and 27 that Paul refers to homosexual behavior between men or women as being an unnatural state as a result of a fallen nature. He further condemns homosexual behavior as vile and shameful. In 1 Corinthians 6, 9, and 10, he lists sexual practices between members of the same gender, along with drunkenness, fornication, and other vices that exclude people from God's kingdom. In 1 Corinthians 1, 9 through 11, Paul calls homosexuality sodomites and places this in along with murder, pointing out that God clearly condemns condemnation of it. But there is good news. In 1 Corinthians 6, 9, Paul says that former homosexuals who have become leaders, who have become believers, such were some of you, but you were washed, but you were sanctified, but you were washed, but you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of God. So even in Paul's time, God was delivering people from their sins. The idea that someone who has become homosexual lives a Christ-centered life is nothing new. So as you can see through this information that if you don't understand what the person is going through, it's hard to... Well, let me just say, for me, it was my connection with him as a child. My relationship with him growing up was, we didn't connect at all. He was a salesman for a chemical company when I was really young, and so he was never home. And when he was home, he seemed to be more involved with other things, and so I didn't feel I at a subconscious level I didn't feel that he was safe and welcoming to me. And as I grew older, we moved to the farm, and my feelings of the farm was it wasn't that I didn't like the farm. It was that it seemed that the farm was more important than me. He was a very determined person to get this farm working, which now I totally understand that, but growing up I didn't understand. It just felt like I was a hired man. I wasn't that important. We were talking about it last night about it being a power struggle, and I said, Dad, you know what? It wasn't a power struggle. It was I wanted your attention, and so if the only way I could get it was to make you angry, at least it was something. He is the person that expects good things, and so. Praising me or being proud of me. It just seemed like something that was just expected. And as high school came, there was no connection. Matter of fact, I went to a private boarding school because it was such a relief because it got to the point where I didn't want to be around him. The farther away from him, the better. So then when I graduated from high school, the realization that I didn't have to listen to him anymore. I wasn't under his control. I could do whatever I wanted to do. And that's when I decided to, quote, come out of the closet. Was living in Omaha, had moved to Omaha, and it just went downhill from there. It was, my thoughts were, I could find a significant other, we could be Christians and do the June and Ward Cleaver gay version to prove to Dad and the church that you can be in the lifestyle and you can be a Christian at the same time. Well, over the next 10 years, the realization was that it's not going to happen. And I was living with a guy out in Grand Island because I thought, well, you know, at least out in Grand Island, you're not where the clubs are, you're not where all everything's going on. But I became very depressed, extremely depressed. And finally just got to the point where I was up one night Watching Benny Hinn. And personally, I don't like Benny Hinn. I don't approve of what he talks about, but that's what was on. We had cable, and that was what was on the Christian channel at the time. But it was, God came to me that night, and it was a warm sensation, almost like he was wrapping his arms around me. And he just said, "You know what, son? I love you, but I can't continue to let you do what you're doing. You either need to turn your life around or I'm bringing you home." And, even then, there was a choice. I could have decided to say, "You know what, Lord, I don't want to change. I want to keep doing what I'm doing." But in my mind, at that time, there wasn't an option. I called my parents, I talked to mom, and I said, "I want to come home." And she said, "We can't let you do that." And she said, "You need to get yourself some help." And she had been sending me information about Exodus International, which is an ex-gay organization that has live-in programs that you can go to that help you, deal with your issues, and the big thing is to just become closer to Christ and to realize how much He does care about you and how much He does love you. And in my deluded thinking at the time, there was a live-in program in San Rafael, California, which is, I mean, it's a San Francisco suburb. And my thoughts were, well, you know what, if this doesn't work, at least I'm in the gay capital and we'll just go from there. And it was a God thing because nobody answered the phone. I called a couple times and no one answered. And because my thoughts were, I don't want to go to Wichita. Who wants to go to Wichita, Kansas? I want to go someplace fun. Yeah. I thought, well, there was one, on the East Coast in Kentucky, or one in Tennessee, and I thought, well, I don't want to go there. So I called the program. She answered first ring, and she talked about this program, and it didn't sound too bad until she said the program is a year long. And again, in my deluded thinking, I said, God, you expect me to be away from my partner for a year? And now I look back and think, what were you thinking? I did it. It was a battle between my flesh and my spirit. My spirit wanted to do what's right, and my flesh did not. And so it was a big battle. So I set up a time to go down there, and went to got all my stuff out of my partner's house, which was the hardest thing, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, with the realization that this relationship is over. And so well, we had kind of gone through this before, and Dad and I were still not getting along whatsoever, and he didn't believe this was for real. So, but Mom, being the wonderful person that she is, talked him into following me down. And because I think she was afraid that I wouldn't follow through. I don't know, but I went down there, and for the next year, it was spiritual warfare. Big time. Big time spiritual warfare. And I think, the big thing is that there were people in the church, straight men, who came alongside of me and accepted me. It was, my first thoughts were, why do these straight men even want to be around me? Aren't they going to afraid that I'm going to try and come on to them, or you know, whatever? And it was just not that that ever happened, but it was just amazing to me that they would come alongside of me, and you know, like I talked about, they knew, you know, you know, they didn't know exactly what the battle was, but they knew I was under spiritual attack. And I, you know, there was a lot of prayers that went up, and yeah, it was a battle. But the battle has been won. It's been a fight. It's been a struggle. It's been something I don't want to see anybody have to go through. On the flip side, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but Dad and I have a relationship better than we've ever had. That was a battle too. We had to forgive each other. That was a big thing of just. I'm trying to find my. I had it written down. There's a verse in the Bible that I hang on to. That. I don't know how this even happened, but was very instrumental in helping me as far as forgiveness. It was easier to forgive him than it was to forgive myself. It was easier to accept forgiveness from God than it was to forgive myself. And so during this struggle, God gave me Philippians 3:13-14, where it says, "Brethren, I do not regard myself as having laid hold of it yet, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead. I press on towards a goal for the prize of the upward call of Christ in Jesus." And I guess for me, that's we're leaving it all behind. You know, it's not worth it. It's not godly. That way of life is very demonic, and it's more demonic than I ever realized it was. But anyway, getting back to the relationship with Dad. It's not been easy. But it's nice to know he's got my back. He's helped me out in so many ways that I never thought he would. There were so many years that I just felt like he didn't want anything to do with me. He moved me to Wichita so he wouldn't have to deal with me. Just the thing he's done. You know, but over the last 10 years, I've been in Wichita, 10 years? Just that peace of that I'm forgiven, that he's forgiven me, God's forgiven me, I've forgiven myself. And we're headed forward. And that's why I don't like to talk about this anymore. It's not an issue that I don't even want to talk about it. But, you know, God has said to me, if there's somebody you can help, even one, this is what I'm asking you to do. And if you've ever, you know, been in, everything's being in ministry is fun. it's wonderful, I'm helping people, and you know, which is true, but there are some ministries like mine who, you know, I don't want to do this, but sometimes God tells you to do something even though you don't want to do it. And again, you have a choice. Your choice is either to be obedient or not to do it. Just like, you know, moving to Wichita and going through that program, I did not want to do that at all. But I knew I had to be obedient to Christ. I had to be. We hear through the media how change is not possible. You can't change. But that's not a true statement. It's just not. But you have to learn. I had to learn to, like I talked about, separating my desires from doing what is right. And that's hard to do, you know, no matter what you're involved in, whether it's pornography, drinking too much, you know, just whatever it is, we have a tendency to put degrees onto sin. And homosexuality seems to be in the top five. So, you know, we have to learn that, we have to realize that sin is sin. That, you know, y'all haven't sinned any more than I have in God's eyes. Which is hard to comprehend, because it even is hard for me. You know, God has forgiven the person who has lied to me, and also the person who tried to kill me. So, it's just how do you quite understand that?
During the year that you were in Wichita, with Exodus, is that where they helped you go back to find out why am I the way I am? And
yeah.
Realize that your father was a big factor in that, and then you made the contact with your dad and said, "Dad, we need to talk."
Well, I think for me, a lot of it was the realization of my perception of him. You know, it was our personalities are polar opposites, and I am the more sensitive. I take things to heart, and sometimes he says things that he doesn't. I mean, I take it wrong. I take it more personally, and so growing up, that's just how he is. But I just realized that I can't change him. That was the big thing. I can't change him. This is the way God created him, and I need to accept him and love him just as he is. I can't expect him to change in the way I think he needs to.
When did you first get the realization? Was it from him that you had blown it as a dad with him? And by the way, I compliment both of you. To undo it and bring yourself out here from this.
Amen.
And to bury yourself. And for you to be able to sit here and hear your son tell you that, you know, growing up, Dad, you blew it with me. So how did you come to realization of that? Did he tell you? And was it a 2-4
sign? Yeah, we need to hear.
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, absolutely. It's a picture. Oh, it is. And it's the opportunity that, as Chuck mentioned, to share with you guys, because you know somebody or you want to know more about it. And Chuck and I have come to realize that the church as a whole really doesn't have many answers in this area. As a matter of fact, when Chuck finally came out of the closet, so to speak, and told me that he was gay, I didn't know where to turn. And, you know, my pastor, with some help, from the standpoint that he pointed out that homosexuality wasn't any worse than any other sin, that God sees all sin as bad. And that was helpful for me, because as Chuck mentioned, for most people it's in the top five, and it was for me too. But first thing I had to do, if I could get my, usually if I go to solve a problem, if I can figure out what the problem is, then I start working on it. And so to identify the problem was important. So the first thing I did was go to bookstores and start finding books and start reading. And one of them that I read was this book by Tim LaHaye on what everyone should know about homosexuality. I mean, it was written in 1973, but it still is pertinent for today. In answer to your question, when did I first start to know? I mean, Chuck was always, he was small built right off the bat. He wasn't athletic. And he was shy. When he was born and I would hold him and I'd rock him, I always had to put him on my knee and hold him up and burp him that way, because if I held him up close, he would burp, he would puke on me every time, you know. So I had to hold him out here. And it wasn't, I think part of it came about just because of misperceptions which he had concerning me, my intentions, who I was, and so forth, because he was more sensitive than I was. So, in answer to your question, when did you first start? I mean, you probably have an inkling of it right off the bat. You know, that, he likes softer things. He likes gentler things. He doesn't like to be roughed around all that much. You speak kindly to him. You don't, you can't raise your voice, or otherwise he gets his feelings hurt very easily. So those, I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't aware of some of the sensibilities there. I just didn't know how to handle it.
So you kind of ignored it.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, when you're first starting out, you're busy.
On a lot too.
You're busy. I mean, I was teaching vocational agriculture at the time. I had five classes of ag that I taught. I had young farmers, an adult farmer class, and FFA. So that just occupied my time entirely. And then we moved from Pender to York, and I was worked for Ziva Geigy, and I was on the road a lot of the time. Not that I had meetings that I was putting on. I was busy. And so the point is that I suppose ignore would be the right word. I probably ignored it, because when I came home, I was tired, and I still had a bunch of paperwork to do. The toughest time, I think, came about when, you know, and the other thing was is we were really active in our church, and church activities took a lot of my time too. And sometimes I look back at that, and I just needed to rework my schedule, you know, and I needed to just spend more time with him and do things with him. The tough time came about when all of a sudden we were out at the state lights in Fremont. We were camping out. And he had a lot of girlfriends, and I mean that in a strict sense, friends. And one of these gals' names was Tammy Hill. And she was a gal that he had met in Omaha.
We were dating.
Okay. Anyhow, she came out to the lake that night, and, you know, we were sitting around the picnic table and eating supper, and I just shared the four spiritual laws with her. And when it came to the part of accepting Christ, she did. And she prayed the prayer. And I was on cloud nine, going, wow, you know, I actually got the opportunity to see someone come to Christ. And this was really great. And so when we had finished that up, Dee visited with her a little bit. Chuck and I went for a little walk, and I just says, I don't remember just what I said, but he told me that. He said, you know, I've got this, I'm gay. I said, it can't be. I mean, yeah, you may feel that way, but you can't be acting out on it. And he said, yeah, I am.
Well, I wasn't at that time, though. But go ahead.
So that was a tough time, because then something needed to be done. And, you know, sometimes through our course, from there between 12 and 20, and you're going through that puberty period, you really need somebody to come alongside of you and say, hey, you're okay. You know, yeah, you're going through some tough times, and you're going through some struggles, but you're okay. And, I mean, it's tough on boys and girls. I mean, junior high has got to be your worst time in a kid's life, in a person's life, probably, because you're in a formative year. You're changing, and things are happening. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I was aware of it, but other things were more important.
He picked up on the fact that he was not important. His other things were.
Yeah, he's
never exacerbated the problem.
He's very perceptive, and he's very sensing. Did I say that right? Perceptive and feeling. And I'm
intuitive
and judging. You know, so he was right. Our personalities are
polar opposites.
Quite a bit different.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about detaching from mom?
Mom and I have always been close. And when in those early years when I needed to detach from her, he wasn't around. So there was nobody there was nobody there, so I stayed attached to her.
Can I ask for a clarification of terms? When you use the word detach and attach, what are you actually trying to communicate? What do you want us to
understand? I needed to, how do you say that? I needed him to come alongside of me. That's what I needed to show me.
You need male confirmation?
Exactly.
Not female.
That's exactly right. I needed him to show, like I said, I needed him to show me what masculinity really was. And the way he was showing me masculinity, I couldn't be that at all. I knew I couldn't. You know, I couldn't be a big, strong Nebraska football player. I couldn't, do all the things that he did. I wanted to please him, especially early on, but I knew I couldn't. Things never seemed to be good enough. And so I quit trying. I quit trying. And that was my detachment. Anything
from him?
Yes.
Okay,
from Mom and I never...
She's got to be a factor in here.
Maybe I can shed some light on this. When we moved back to the farm, one of the deals was that she wanted to go... My wife's very gregarious. She's a great salesperson. And so she wanted to do Mary Kay. And I said, kind of in a whim, I said, if we move back to the farm, why...
Well, she didn't want a farm. She wanted to.
Yeah, she really didn't want a farm. She thought she'd married a teacher or salesman, but anything but a farmer. And when I got back to the farm, there was a lot of work to do, and we had a lot of development to do, a lot of just structural things to do. So she went to work as a sales rep for Mary Kay and became a director with Mary Kay and came in with she had a pink car. And...
which I drove to high school.
Which he ended up driving to high school. And I just kept putting the things on. The point that came out of that was he came to the impression that she was the breadwinner in the family, which definitely was not so. But because she spent the time with him and so forth, it was a misperception. I think, Romans points it out in a lot of ways. You know, we suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and sometimes it's consciously and sometimes it's unconsciously.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, mom was more inviting and safe. Dad was not. You know, I didn't want to be around him. I didn't want to be chewed out. That was just it. He always thought that... you know, I was lazy and I didn't want to do all those things, and it wasn't that at all. It's just I didn't want to be around him.
Would it be safe to say that if you did receive confinement, some kind of verbal from your father, it was in a negative tone?
Exactly.
Rather than affirmation.
That's exactly right. It was that's right. I hate to say that, but that was exactly how it was. It was when, because I was involved in you know, FFA and 4-H and tried to do the things that that he did, but it never seemed to be good enough. I couldn't do it well enough, and I was interested in horses, and he hated that to no end. Oh my gosh, because it didn't make any money doing it. Yeah.
And the horse shows were always on Sunday. So that can't
Saturday night. Saturday. But you know, it was something that I really enjoyed, and he wasn't really he did bend and a little bit, but for the most part, he hated every minute of it. He still does to this day. But, because I now have two horses now. Hates it. But, you know, that was something I really enjoyed. And he didn't want anything to do with that. Nothing at all. And I was involved in sports, but wasn't very good at it. Was a good bench warmer, but my perception was he didn't want to come to any of the basketball games or track and field events because he was embarrassed of me, because I wasn't good at it, and that was true. But you know, how would you feel having to go to a basketball game and your son's the one who's sitting on the bench and you're sitting next to a father whose son is the star player? I mean, you know, so now I can understand that. At the time I didn't understand it. So anyway,
one other thing should be mentioned too, and that was when we lived in New York, we lived right across the street from a teacher who really had become a good friend of ours. He and his wife, and they had four kids.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be a pretty safe environment. And at about, three and a half years of age, this guy de-pants Chuck and did some kind of bad things. And he mentioned that. Chuck mentioned that to me, and I thought, oh, you grunt that, or you're, you know, that didn't really happen. I mean, this guy is a teacher. He's this can't be so. And so I really denied that.
Oh, yes.
But it left a really lasting impact on his life. And the thing that we're finding out now is that when people who had experiences like that find themselves in really intense situations, their emotional level immediately drops back to that point in time when they were violated. So their reaction to that, their perception of it, the way they handle that thing is at a very juvenile level. And it's very difficult to rise above that level in dealing with tense situations.
I got a quick question. When it came to when you did come out with the church and everything, with, you know, I don't know if you were actually attending church at the time.
Yeah.
What was your experience with, and have you seen since then, it's my assumption that at the church the whole week tried to ignore the problem instead of dealing with it. And that has been the biggest problem. And has the church started at least, I know, in my view, I think we're getting, we are trying to understand better, like, since we're even having this meeting right now. But how was it when you first came out, and is it, are we improving in that area as a church?
As a church in a whole, no.
No improvement?
Not a whole lot. The church that the ministry is connected with, you know, they were very supportive. But as a whole, and the second church I went to, where I went to college, I just felt like it was more, we'll tolerate you. I had a ministry over there, which was an XK ministry, and it was just kind of, well, you just do your own thing. And then I went to another church, and I got the same kind of response of, well, you just kind of do your own thing, and we're going to keep you, we're going to control you and what you can and can't do with this ministry. And yeah, it just became very discouraging. So I'm going to a new church, and we'll see how. I haven't talked to the pastor yet. We'll see how this goes. But yeah, as a general rule, and I've tried big churches and little churches. They're all. I won't talk about it. They, you know, it's kind of like when, you know, you sit down with somebody and you say, I used to be in the gay lifestyle. And they give, you know, they just, it's just kind of like, okay, that kind of shock feel, shock. It's not even the look, though. It's more of a, they don't know what to say. Yeah.
Very uneasy, uncomfortable, not knowing how to act or react. Ask the question or answer the question. So the best way, the safest way, is to avoid it.
Yeah.
Now, I can identify a little bit in that I'm the proud father of two severely mentally and physically retarded daughters. So people that get around my daughters, the first thing is they want to go veer off this way. And if they're headed toward him and they see me with one of them, and they kind of look and they kind of riches, oops, she's abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're off here. So, but we as humans, we normally have something that we don't feel comfortable with. We don't have an answer for. And if you write, you know, smack dab, because I already said, no, Dick, I want you to know I'm gay. Oh, really? Yeah, I gotta go tell Charlie. I'm sorry, dude. So, we're shocked because we're not prepared. We have not pre-thought. What am I gonna do if my friend comes to me or my neighbor comes to me and says that you're gay, or my nephew? Well, I think as adults and as children of the Father, we need to pre-think and analyze that. Where am I on this? What is my reaction going to be? Am I going to ostracize him? Am I going to now be the Holy Spirit and judge him? Or what?
I was going to say, as a Christian man, what's probably the biggest way we can reach out to homosexuals?
Just come alongside them. Be their, be their friend. Be that. Just be a friend to them. You need to feel. They need to feel safe, and that's going to take a long time to do that. But, because they're going to be going through a whole lot of emotions. And, you know, just so you know how severe their struggle really is and how hard it is for them to even be around you because you're male. It's just, you know, they're trying to do that separation, and here this man is coming alongside of me, willing to accept me, but he's straight, and I'm confused because every other time it was he wanted sex with me, and that was our way of connecting. Well, so to connect with a male in a non-sexual way is a process, and you have to be willing to help him through that process, which can be a battle and a half. But
Chuck, I hear what you're saying. And I'm saying, okay, so for the friends and acquaintances that I have, including close relatives who are gay, and as I try to spend time with these guys and just hanging out and just befriending them and just trying to love them, let them know that I accept them, you're saying that that is can be a real struggle for them?
Exactly. It can be. I mean, yeah. It's not... especially if you're wanting to come alongside of them and be their, like, be a mentor, you know, because that's really what they need. But somebody, you know, in a situation like you're talking about, let them know that, you know, it's okay. You know, if you want to do this, that's okay. I'm not going to accept what you're doing. I love you as a person, and I will, you know, I want that relationship with you, but I'm not going to have this relationship with you. In the fact of, you know, we're not going to go to the bar together, and, you know, I will put boundaries that, you know, like mom and dad did, you can't bring any of your friends home. I don't want to see, you know, whatever your boundaries are. And they need to respect that. And if they don't, then you walk away. But, you know, the biggest thing is prayer. That's just, I mean, because that's all you can do. Mom and Dad tried. You couldn't, you weren't going to convince me. And I think for me, when it finally broke is when they totally backed off. We were at the hospital in Omaha, remember? And Larry and I were out front, because he had to go, we were at the same hospital, and I don't remember what he went in for, but we were standing out in the parking lot, and Dad came out and talked to Larry like he was a normal person. Just, you know, there wasn't that kind of... Yeah, he talked to him. There was no that kind of standoffishness, or because if you've ever been around Dad, he's a big conversationalist. He will talk your leg off. Well, but he talked to Larry like he was, and I just kind of went, where is this coming from? Normally he would have, you know, I don't even want to talk to him. And they had said that to me many times. You know, we'll accept you and let you in, but we don't want anything to do with him. And my thoughts were, well, you know, he's a person too. But that was one of their end boundaries, and that's okay. And I came to the point where I understand. But when they quit harping about, because every phone call it was, you need to quit and you need to stop, and you know, it was just that constant. How do I even describe that? That constant feeling of disapproval of me as a person. Because in the lifestyle, you intertwine yourself. Who you are is gay. That's who you are. There's not really a separation there's not a separation. This is who I am. So you need to accept, if you're going to accept me, you need to accept my way of life. But he finally did that to where he did separate it. And that's when things broke for me, that, yeah, you know what? Dad's right. Even though at the time I didn't want to admit that. But, I mean, he was right, but it was all in my perception and the way he went about, the way he went about it. That was just it. When he finally backed off, that worked. That was the starting point.
Chuck,
yeah.
You know, I want to make sure I'm hearing this right.
Okay.
And as I've listened to you share from the get-go, from an early age, it's as if you were mostly subconsciously conditioned to think the way you did in terms of gender and everything. And yeah, there were places along the road that you had to make some decisions for which you were responsible. Some of these decisions, sounds like on both sides, on your side and on your dad's, were based on perceptions that may not have been correct.
Right.
Okay, so then you get to the point where God really deals with you and you say, I'm going to go to Wichita. You go to Wichita and you start really fully understanding what God's got in all this for you. But then you made the statement, when you were telling us about Wichita, then you made the statement, that lifestyle is very demonic because you talk about the satanic oppression that you experienced during that year.
Yeah.
What At what point did you realize that this really was a demonic lifestyle? Was it when you got to Wichita? Was it before then? Or did you always have kind of an inkling growing up?
I didn't have any inkling of it growing up. It was probably in Wichita that as I looked back to what I had done while I was in the lifestyle, I just realized how demonic it really is. It was amazing to me as I look back, because there's kind of like stages of it. You know, you first come out and it's wonderful. You know, sin is great for a season because everybody accepts you, everybody understands. You know, you're the new kid on the block. You're wonderful. Then the next stage is, you know, and then you get involved in a relationship, and then that falls apart, and it all snowballs from there until you get to the point where, how do I even say that? It just becomes demonic in that you just come to the point where you just don't care. You don't care about yourself. You don't care about anything. And so you do things that you would normally never do. And that's, I'll just leave it at that.
The guy helped me a lot. He said all addictive behaviors are really difficult to pull out of. Whether it's pornography or alcoholism or just take smoking, for example. They're really hard to pull out of. And then he made a statement. He said all families are dysfunctional. And that was his initial premise. All families are dysfunctional. Some are more so than others. And some get it figured out, and some never do. And I went back to the original premise of all families are dysfunctional, and then I came to the Romans passage, which says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So if we've all fallen short, and we may marry somebody who's also fallen short, and then we produce children who fall short, then the statement is true. But it helped a lot because at that point, it helps remove some of the guilt because you realize you're not just the only one that has messed up. And you know, I'll admit, just as you know, the way in which I handled Chuck's situation was not right. You know, but I got my priorities straight, changed around, and that, you know, work and success and all the things that we were trying to accomplish were more important than what the family was. And it was just really difficult because if he would pitch in to help out, which wasn't very often, oftentimes he would deliberately screw it up to get attention. And
because negative attention was better than no attention at all. Well, if you take any kind of psychology class, that's what they talk about. You know, these rebellious kids are, that's what they're doing. They're wanting your attention. So they'll do whatever it takes to get it. To me, Dad was perfect. This is what a man is supposed to be, and I can't do it. But he was perfect. And so you kept striving to, and I guess for me, the realization that he's not, that he has issues that he deals with, he didn't have the best childhood either. That, you know, there were, you know, I don't know exactly what went on, but I just sensed that it was tough. You know, growing up, I had two sets of parents. I had, you know, mom and dad, and I had my grandparents. And, you know, you think dad was gruff. Well, grandpa could run you into the ground. And so you can see where it came from. And so, you know, neither one of them knew how to deal with me. They just thought I was lazy and I didn't want to do anything and on and on and on. Well, it wasn't that at all. It wasn't that at all. Because I remember when I graduated from high school, I thought, there is no way I'm going to farm with him. No way. And it wasn't that I didn't want to farm. I didn't want to farm with him. So,
when you came out of the hospital, do you remember that situation of walking over to the two of them?
Mm-hmm.
And in a normal way, just conversation with Larry, remember? Mm-hmm. What happened with you to make that paradigm shift where you did that?
I don't think I can answer that question. I don't.
You want to take a commercial and think about it?
He was there.
Yeah, he was there, and I wasn't going to be rude to him. I mean, I didn't hate him. I didn't even know him, actually. I mean, I just visited with him as I would visit with anybody else. You know, just to get acquainted, to get to know who he was, see what his value system was. And he had a little get up and go. I mean, he owned a trailer court, and he was collecting rents off the trailer courts, and
he was working for FedEx. I mean, he was.
Chuck ended up cleaning them up after the guys moved out.
Hey, Chuck, is it true that in a homosexual relationship, there's usually one that's dominant?
Yes. Yes.
Talk about that.
There's usually one that's dominant, one that's submissive, and I was a submissive one, which means I was always interested in men who were butch, who were, I mean, if you saw him walking on the street, there's no way you could even tell. Unlike, you know, there are guys that you see that are very, I mean, it's obvious. Yeah, and to the extreme. Not that I was to the, I was to the extreme at a couple points. But I wanted to be his wife. Not in the sense of that. Yeah.
You screwed up thinking.
Exactly. I wanted to be his wife. I wanted to play that role.
Well, then how does the philosophy and the struggle that you shared growing up on your side in being submissive, how does the homosexual male dominant, is he also playing out a dominant role from his father?
That's exactly right. He is replacing Dad. I'm having the relationship with him that I wanted with Dad because he's giving me attention. He's spending time with me. He is giving all the things. It's just then there was the sexual part of it on top of it because it kind of got to the point of, well, to keep him around, this is what I've got to do.
Thank you. One more step, too, and that is, those guys that are predators are looking for an orgasmic experience. And they really don't care who it's with or anything. As a matter of fact, they'll have a whole number of partners. And it's not unlike the heterosexual male who just says he's out for conquest to have just as many orgasmic experiences as he can.
Well, I remember going to the bar one time with my brother, and as I was there, it's the same game. It's the same game that you know, just like Dad talked about. It's a conquest. It's the same thing as a gay bar. I mean, you know, you walk in there and your conquest for the night is to get laid. I mean, that's just what it is. And you put drugs and alcohol on top of it, and you know that's what happens. And to me, it was just like, this isn't any different. It's the same thing. Are we?
I'm trying to deal with my attitude. I get along pretty well with divorcees and, you know, adulterers. Because I can see myself doing that. I think I'm not above that. So I think I'm in touch with that much of my depravity. You know, it's more than dysfunction, I'm just depraved. But I haven't quite, you know,
Well, and I think...
Sin is sin, and I think...
Exactly. Well, and I think that's...
In that way, and therefore I tend to judge.
That's totally understandable. When there's something that you don't understand,
see,
it's hard...
Something that I need to work out, not with homosexuals, but with God. That I'm worse, way worse than I even think I am.
Well,
and then I extend a lot more grace.
Well, and it's, you know, like I talked about, it is separating the sin from the sinner. Even if it's a sin that you don't understand. How do I describe that? There are, I guess for me, a sin that I don't understand is, why would you cheat on your wife? Even in the lifestyle, They cheat all the time. That was not my objective. I would never have done that. If I'm with somebody, that's who I'm with. Why would you need to cheat on them? But it happens all the time. Why? I don't understand. I don't get it. So for me, to be around somebody that... I mean, I did marriage counseling when I was in school. And, you know, usually the guy or the woman had cheated, and that's why they're in counseling. But, you know, yeah, I did it by the book at the time, but it was just, I don't understand, you know, why you would do that. I mean, I kind of do, sort of, but I just understand. But, so it is hard because I could not see myself in that situation. Just like you're saying, it's, yeah. You can't relate to...
I mean, I've been married 40 years. I've only known one woman, and it's wonderful, but I sure see myself there. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I cannot get around Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount. You know, Jesus said, have you committed adultery? And he said, oh, no. You know, and Jesus said, well, let me raise the standard a little bit here. In fact, it's way higher than you think. Have you thought about it? You're just as guilty.
Yeah. And I think you hit it though right on the head that it's hard for straight men to be around people that are struggling because they can't fathom the idea.
I need to get there. Yeah. I
don't understand at all.
Yeah.
And that, you know, just like Dad was talking, he didn't understand. I don't get it. I can't relate to that. If I can't solve the problem, if I can't relate to it, then I don't know what, then, you know, I'll just push it away.
Well, I was pressed yesterday at lunch with a friend of mine, and he said, why is my son gay? I don't understand this. But his wife is dead now, the Lord's dead, but she was very manipulative and controlling of the kids. Extremely. I don't think they ever unhooked from her. She wouldn't let them.
Yeah.
I was kind of pressing, you know, how did you detach?
I didn't. I didn't detach from Mom because I felt like he wasn't welcoming and safe. You know, and that things were more important than me. Work, especially. I remember that was a big battle growing up. And I remember telling you that. It just seems work is more important than anything else. And you know, he didn't really have a response to that. Because he didn't think it was true, I don't think. I don't know.
Well, you said you were aware. It's an awareness thing, you know what I mean?
Well, there's, you know, everybody needs love and acceptance. And we need to develop a sense of self-worth. And, you know, that comes about...
But we go get it at the wrong place.
You know, yeah.
And work from...
The old song, All the Lonely People, where did they all come from? You know, it's just kind of like, where do I find love and acceptance? I always remember my pastor saying, you know, dads, hug your daughters, because if you don't, somebody else will. It's the same thing, you know, with hugging your sons, too, and roughhousing with them a little bit, and doing things with them, and playing with them. And we used to do a lot of snowmobiling together. And
that was fun.
You know, things that we used to do. I think part of it is Chuck kind of forgot some of those things too, and we used to go on vacations and trips, and And I, you know, I provided him with a horse trailer to pick up so he could go to, even though I didn't want him going on Sundays.
Actually, it was Saturday night, so I was so tired Sunday morning.
But I think a lot comes about in just realizing there's two things. First of all, that we have self-worth. Secondly, realizing, as Romans 5 points out, that God loved us so much that he willingly died on the cross. Even when we were enemies of Christ, he willingly went ahead and died on the cross. And, you know, just to realize that somebody really does love us, you know, you just got to get your head around.
Well, the big thing is, and it's not just for me, but it's for everybody, we have to get our love and acceptance from Christ first. Because he's not going to let you down. He's never going to walk away. He's never going to hurt you. That was hard for me to wrap my mind around, because anytime I started to trust anybody, they did something to break that trust. It was everybody. Everybody. And so to fathom the idea that God loves me, God has forgiven me, God wants to spend time with me, all I need to do is make the effort to spend time with him. And to realize that, you know, there's a song that I keep thinking about. He just says in this song, what sin? God's saying to you, what are you talking about? Why do you keep bringing this up? Let's go forward. Leave that crap back there, because it's gone. It's in the sea of forgetfulness. So, you know, you're the one who needs to, like, get over it. Exactly. You know, and he, you know, and that's why, you know, I just mentioned in the beginning, I don't like doing these talks, because I don't like to even think about it.
Have you done this much before together?
Not together. We've done it. I've done it a couple times with him and a couple times with Mom.
This is very effective. Keep following the Lord's leading, buddy.
Well, it's not easy.
This is really a lot of pain associated with it that you have to go through.
But it's.
Are you doing a ministry? You mentioned being a part of a ministry.
Well, I had a ministry going, and then it kind of, I was at a church in Wichita, and it just fell apart. I wasn't getting support from them like I needed.
You had to bear the anger of Christians.
Yeah, well, it was just, there was no support. There was nobody to come alongside of me and help me. It was, you know, you want to run this ministry, go. You know, this is the, and these are your parameters of what you can and can't do. Instead of somebody come along.
It's hard not to just do any kind of ministry. Oh,
yeah. And if you have no idea what you're doing, it's just, I needed somebody to come alongside of me and just help me. But it didn't happen. And so hopefully this new church, he will go in and talk to him and see what he says. But yeah, I've got to keep. Yeah. The ministry needs to get started again, and I don't really want to do it. I've been putting it off and keep putting it off. Elder, I'll do it tomorrow. Well, tomorrow never comes. Just because it is such a struggle, it's hard to find support. You know, nobody wants to donate to a Next Game ministry. That's just it right there. I mean, that was the big thing is the financial part of it, because no one wanted to support the ministry. And I'm sorry, but it costs money to have a website, to have a phone, to make brochures. You know, when I was running it, I didn't pay myself at all. It was just, you know, that kind of stuff. And when I would do some talks, you know, usually the church would, you know, take a donation for the service, but there was no commitment as far as continuing to donate to this ministry. You know, we'll go ahead and donate to, you know, make donations to this ministry, but we'll just do a one-night gift and then be gone. We don't want anything to do with you. So it was, yeah, it just got to the point where I only had one good donor, and I just thought, we can't, I'm so tired of this. I'm so tired of the rejection. And because I tend to take things personally, because you're rejecting this ministry, you're rejecting me. And, you know, that's not the case. That wasn't the case. Oh, exactly. And it'll happen. It's just that I want things to happen now. I want them to be perfect. I think everybody should, you know, should be supporting ministries like this one. But,
well,
you know. Yeah. Well, somebody else had mentioned that to me too.
Yeah, you can do it.
But the big thing is, because I'm not a 501(c), people won't get a tax deduction, and so yeah.
Or just multiply it from something small, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
It isn't that big a deal to become a 501(c).
You are a lot more confident right now. See, you're sitting up here looking. You got eye contact with us. You didn't
it takes
out.
Me a while you to get warmed up.
what's made the difference?
Just the conversation. I mean, you know, everybody seems accepting of me as a person. We still struggle with that.
That's Galatians, what is it, 1:10, Paul says, I'm not doing this for men's approval.
Well, and that's something that I mean, I battled all the way up here, is that, you know, I've got so much going at home, and I really need to be there, and, you know, when Dad asked me to do this, I thought, well, I'm doing this for him. He's done all these good things for me, so, fine, I'll go up there and do this. And that's honesty. I mean, it really is. I didn't want to do this. Matter of fact, last night I was trying to talk him out of it. Just do it yourself. I don't want to do this. Well, because I did a talk last night for a youth group in Fremont, and it was a catastrophe. It was a mess. And I was tired, and I didn't want to do it. That was just it. I told Lisa last night, I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to talk about it. I got to leave it behind. And she said the same thing. She says, you know what? You have a big ministry right there. And she said, you probably touched somebody's life in that youth group that you didn't even realize. I'm like, but me being a perfectionist, even like just now, this, it didn't go the way I wanted it to at all. And so I just, but, you know, if I helped, great. I hope I did.
You did.
Yeah, definitely.
Can I give you one verse just to really encourage you?
Okay.
Paul, at the end of his ministry, when he was an old guy, this is his, not the Acts testimony, but this is, right, I thank God who has given me strength. You got this under Christ Jesus. He judged me faithful. He appointed me to this service. Remember, this is Timothy. This is at the end of Paul's ministry. Though formerly I was a blasphemer, a persecutor, and an insolent opponent. Well, he's unzipped his life right there. He's telling them that like it is, right? I was an angry guy. Can you imagine Paul going to a town, ministering, and some lady comes up and said, why did you kill my husband? You know, that's some nasty stuff. But I received mercy because I had acted ignorantly in unbelief. Well, that's what you said. I didn't believe God. I didn't believe God. So unawareness or ignorance. And the grace of our Lord overflowed for me with faith and love that are in Christ Jesus. This saying is trustworthy and deserving. acceptance. That's an interesting way to introduce. All right? Listen up. This is Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. And this is at the end of his life, right? He's not trying to convince everybody he's a saint. I don't think he had a poor self-image. Right? He's saying, I'm the worst of all sinners. Oh, don't say that. You're a saint. See, no, I'm not. I'm the worst.
I really like the word where he says, I am and not I was.
Yeah, he didn't say I was. I am.
I am.
But I received mercy for this reason. Why do you think he received mercy? That as the foremost of sinners, Jesus Christ might display his perfect patience, right, toward me, and display that to the world out here, right, as an example to those who were to believe in him for eternal life. God showed his mercy to me, right, so that I'm an example, right? I'm the worst of all sinners. Look at God. Jesus came. This is the gospel, right? I'm a perfect example of God. This is why Jesus came to save sinners. I'm the worst. If God can save me.
Oh, I've said that before.
He can save you. That's what he's saying. Wow. King of ages. To the only God be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. See, this is all about God's glory. It's not about you or what people think of you or anything else about God's glory. So you keep telling your story. Wow. Right?
Yeah.
Because if you're the worst of all, right, God shows his mercy through you to those who are going to believe. 1 Timothy 1.
He must have promised to have a lot of pain involved in his telling his story too.
Right? Oh.